On the 27th of March, the Coffee House Shots team will be joined by special guests to give you their take on a spring statement. We will be live on stage at London's Cadogan Hall. To get your tickets today, visit spectator.co.uk/springstatementlive. We'll see you there.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we pick some of our favourite articles from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Petra Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Colin Freeman explains how Islamic State tightened its grip on the Congo. Harry Ritchie draws attention to the thousands of languages facing extinction this century as he reviews Rare Tongues, The Secret Stories of Hidden Languages by Lorna Gibb. Of the estimated 7,000 spoken currently, only 500 are expected to survive. With thanks to the Endangered Language Alliance, we also include a clip of the Central American language Garifuna being sung. In the first of our pieces included from our school supplement, Max Jeffrey highlights the Boxing Academy changing young lives. And in the second, the Spectator's editor Michael Gove reflects on lessons learned during his time as Education Secretary. And finally, Catriona Olding takes us through the cast of characters that make up her new Provence-based memoir club. Up first, Colin Freeman.
Last month, they beheaded 70 Christians in Maba in the eastern Congo, according to the Catholic charity Aid to the Church in Need, which campaigns on behalf of persecuted Christians worldwide. The charity said the corpses of the victims, including women, children and the elderly, were dumped in a nearby evangelical church. Even in a world accustomed to Islamic State's atrocities, such horrors would normally make headlines, as they used to in Islamic State's old killing fields in Syria and Iraq. Not so when they happen in the Congo, where violence has long been the norm. There are so many different armed groups here that even the most diligent foreign editor struggles to make sense of it. A three-sided civil war is hard enough to explain. A 120-sided one? Forget it. Instead, the only attention the murdered Christians have had in Britain is via the Catholic peer, Lord Alton of Liverpool. What are we doing to confirm those reports? He asked the Upper House recently. Have we raised this with the International Criminal Court and the African Union to ensure that those responsible for this terrible atrocity are brought to justice? His questions are unlikely to get satisfactory answers. While another Christian charity, Open Doors UK, says it's 100% confident that the incident occurred, MONUSCO, the Congo's UN peacekeeping force, is still trying to confirm it a month later. The alleged culprits, who act under the banner of Islamic State's Central Africa province, have vanished into the bush. And even if the UN knew where they were, it has bigger threats to worry about right now. In January, the Rwandan-backed M23 rebel group launched a brazen offensive in the eastern DRC, capturing the regional capital Goma, and sparking fighting that has killed 3,000 civilians and 13 UN peacekeepers and forced nearly 500,000 to flee their homes. It is amid such anarchy that groups like Islamic State, which have failed to regain their strongholds in the Middle East, now see a future. A decade ago, Islamic State's only significant presence in sub-Saharan Africa was in Nigeria, where Boko Haram pledged fealty. Now, though, the black Islamic State flag flutters over trouble spots across the region, from Somalia and gas-rich northern Mozambique to the coup-ridden Sahel nations of Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger. Ever since the beginning of the war on terror, security officials have warned that Africa's impoverished central belt, home to nearly a dozen failed states and large Muslim populations, could become jihadism's last redoubt. With Donald Trump abandoning America's role as world policeman and Europe preoccupied with its own security challenges, that seems more probable than ever. Congo's jihadists started life as a militant Islamist sect in neighbouring Uganda in the 1990s, operating under the innocuous name of Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF. They were funded by local dictators such as Congo's Mobutu and Sudan's Omar al-Bashir, who saw them as pawns in regional mischief-making. Clashes with Ugandan troops then forced the ADF over the border into eastern Congo, where it embraced full-blown jihadism. Today, despite stiff competition, it's considered the most violent of all the Eastern Congo's armed groups. Its founder, Mr. Makulu, was born a Christian, David Stephen, but converted to radical Islam and then travelled to Sudan, where he's thought to have met Osama bin Laden. In 2010, the Foreign Office launched an investigation into United Nations claims that he was raising funds for the group while working in London. Since 2015, he's been in jail in Uganda, awaiting trial on terrorism charges. But his group, meanwhile, has gone from strength to strength, with up to 2,000 followers. Like Boko Haram, it recruits and kidnaps child soldiers and sees schools as targets for headline-grabbing atrocities. Despite the hopes of Lord Alton, it's unlikely that the ADF's henchmen will face justice. In Nigeria and Somalia, Islamist militants are chased, albeit with limited effectiveness, by Western-backed government forces. In the Sahel, meanwhile, they have to contend with Russian-backed Wagner mercenaries. But in the Eastern Congo, UN and Congolese government forces have their hands full dealing with the chaos caused by the M23 incursion. The group, widely seen as a proxy force for Rwandan leader Paul Kagame, claims to be chasing Hutu genocidaires who fled into Eastern Congo after slaughtering 500,000 Tutsis in 1994. Most analysts, though, think that Kagame is using this as a cover for a land grab on Eastern Congo's mineral assets, which include rare earth deposits. Will Brown, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, likens M23 to Vladimir Putin's Little Green Men, who took Crimea in 2014. But there the comparison ends. For much as the West disapproves of M23, there is a limit to how much they want to alienate its sponsor, Mr. Kagame. While activists criticise his human rights record, Rwanda has prospered under his rule. In contrast to many of its neighbours, aid has been well spent, corruption tamed, governance improved. Rwanda's battle-hardened army is also highly capable and has been helping with counter-insurgency operations in the Central African Republic, Benin and Mozambique, to name but a few. Mr. Kagame is increasingly seen as the region's policeman, for better or worse. All of which means that the West has little leverage over Rwanda as it stirs chaos in the Eastern Congo, beyond making a few threats of sanctions, most of which will now seem even weaker given America's growing rift with Europe. A new war in the Congo may be just the first of many across Africa, and for every strongman like Mr. Kagame flexing his muscles, there may be an Islamic State franchise wielding a machete.
That was Colin Freeman. Next, Harry Ritchie, alongside a clip of the Garifuna language being sung, with thanks to the Endangered Language Alliance.
It is one of academia's horrible ironies that linguistics, the subject devoted to human communication, has managed to communicate nothing about its many startling and fundamental discoveries to the world outside its university departments. So any book such as this linguistic tour of some of the world's exotic, hidden and endangered languages is to be welcomed with sobbing gratitude. Almost all the languages Lorna Gibb describes are staples of linguistics course books, but I'm assuming each one will come as startling news to a general readership. One which was new to me was the sign language used by native North Americans throughout the Great Plains. And thanks to Gibb, I also now know how to interpret their smoke signals. Two puffs equals all is well. Three puffs, help. Four puffs, stranded whale. As only linguists would expect, this tour of the linguistically weird and wonderful soon stops off at one of the lesser visited Canary Islands, Gomera, home to the whistled language known as El Silbo. It has a range of more than a kilometre, about 10 times that of a shout, and its differing whistles remarkably convey not only phonemes but grammatical features such as the tenses of verbs and the gender of nouns. Linguists will also be unshocked to see that another of Gibb's destinations is the group of Khoi San languages in southern Africa, which use various click sounds. I say various. Nama has 20 different clicks, almost all indistinguishable to our ears, but as obvious to a Naman speaker as an F is from a P to us. And so to yet another language that is big only in linguistics, Dyirbal, spoken in North Queensland and boasting a unique system of noun classes that gave George Lakoff the title of his book, Women, Fire and Dangerous Things. The last I heard of it 10 years ago, Dyirbal was hanging on with a handful of speakers, but Gibbs brings the saddening news that its last native speaker is now gone and the language is officially extinct. There is, alas, nothing unusual in that. We are in the middle of an unstoppable process of language extinction. There are around 7,000 languages currently spoken on this planet, and by the end of the century, only 500 will have survived. A few heroic ethnolinguists are currently racing round the Amazon rainforest and Papua New Guinea with their notebooks and tape recorders, but the vast majority of those 6,500 mostly oral languages are doomed to vanish, leaving no trace of themselves. As the author explains, this is not just vaguely regrettable, but a significant loss. Each departing language taking with it not only its charming quirks of syntax or phonetics, but its specialist knowledge of local flora and fauna. A thought-provoking 90% of the Amazon's medicinal plants are linguistically unique, having names and known applications only in one local language. Clearly of a sunnier temperament than me, Gibb tries to accentuate the positive, celebrating various apps and chat rooms that are trying to preserve endangered languages and citing the examples of the revival of Hebrew, the growing campaign to assert Maori as the national language of New Zealand, and the efforts to keep Scottish Gaelic alive. In the final pages, she eventually takes a brief stop off at herself as a dialect-speaking and working-class girl from the estates of Glasgow's hinterland who made her way up the educational ladder until she found herself in the linguistically foreign territory of middle-class London. I could have done with a lot more of her autobiographical material, but then the culture as a whole badly needs that kind of testimony. That's because English is the only language of those 7,000 whose dialects are divided not just by geography, but also by class. The result is that working class speakers of perfectly respectable regional dialects suffer an unforgiving discrimination unless they immediately achieve 100% fluency in the middle class dialect. They will fail. Extremely usefully, an appendix offers a beginner's guide to some of the key topics and terms of linguistics. In any other subject, the information would be laughably basic. The universe is very big and stars are other suns. But such is our collective culture's howling ignorance of anything to do with this subject. These are 22 pages of sorely needed explanations.
That was Harry Ritchie. Next, Max Jeffrey.
It's a typical morning at the Boxing Academy in East London. In the reception, men with handheld metal detectors pat down students, confiscating their belongings and mobile phones for the day. A child has emptied out his pockets and is holding a mucky plastic dental retainer. "Can you have this?" one man with a metal detector asks another. With suspicion, it is permitted. The Boxing Academy is an alternative provision secondary school in Hackney, founded in 2007 on the experimental idea that you could better teach difficult children by making boxing a central part of their education. Students take daily boxing classes, wear navy tracksuits, and are disciplined as boxers would be. At the entrance to the school, an A4 sign is pinned prominently to a wall. It reads, "Punctuality penalties. After 9:45 a.m, 50 push-ups. After 10 a.m, 100 push-ups. After 10:15 a.m, 150 push-ups. I'm watching the morning shakedown and reading the penalty notice when the school's head teacher, Anna Kane, sails in. Short silver hair, flared jeans, roll neck jumper, blazer. She scans a pass and takes me down a corridor into her small office where we sit. She begins by explaining why the children box. The reason it's a boxing academy is, as anyone who's ever joined a boxing gym knows, it's like having a second family," she says. "That level of support and belonging, that's what we're trying to do here. They start out not knowing anything, and they learn jabs, footwork, all the basics, which are actually very complicated. You can hit something hard, but if you want to really hit something hard, you've got to learn the technique. That repetitive nature of learning, the discipline, making mistakes, laughing about it, carrying on, They use that as an example to take into English and maths. The 48 students here, there are 8 classes of 6, are some of the toughest to teach in London. All were once at mainstream schools, but for some reason or other, it didn't work out. Many have special needs. Most come from hard backgrounds. The kids are aged 11 to 16, and alongside their daily 45-minute boxing session, they study a stripped-down curriculum of English, maths, science, art, and BE. I've got so much time for these what we used to call naughty kids, Anna says. They've worked out that if you want to get out of doing something, behave badly. Our job is to break that cycle. Boxing teaches good values, the pared-back syllabus improves focus, and a commitment to discipline improves behaviour. Instead of daydreaming through after-school detentions, badly behaved pupils are punished with push-ups or ordered to clean the gym. Even small infractions of the school's standards have repercussions. 50 push-ups for low trousers, 25 for use of street language. I used to get 500 push-ups a day, says one pupil, remembering a former teacher. One teacher got a bit crazy with the push-ups, Anna admits. Children at the boxing academy are strictly disciplined, but are also counselled through poor conduct with what the school calls their pod leader. They're a kind of mentor, or, as the pupils call them, a professional big brother. There's one pod leader per class, and they sit with the students in every lesson. While the teacher delivers the curriculum, the pod leader manages behaviour. If there is an incident with the teacher or another student, the pod leader will stand outside and have a quick chat with the pupil, Anna says. They'll try to unpick it. If children are in a big school, as we call it, say a kid gets into trouble, they get a couple of days suspension. They come back in afterwards and you sit down and you have a meeting. 2 days later, for a teenager to talk about something they got wrong is absolutely pointless. There is no way that whatever you do to unpick it is going to land with them effectively, she says. There is no way that whatever you do to unpick it is going to land with them effectively, she says. The school also has a resident psychologist who explains to the children the neurology of their outbursts. We leave Anna's office for a tour. The Boxing Academy is currently in a temporary building while a permanent site is being built down the road. In today's incarnation, the school's squat structure is constituted around the gym, in the centre of which is a full-size boxing ring. On the walls are motivational quotes from Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth, reads one from Iron Mike. I meet Jermaine Williams, the vice principal, who runs the boxing curriculum at the academy. We stand at the side of the ring as a group of kids work heavy bags. It feels very calm and normal. Over regular thudding, Jermaine tells me how he wound up here. He arrived in the UK for a 2-week holiday and never went back. I came over from Jamaica at the age of 12, he says. At 16, the Home Office said I needed to make arrangements to go back to Jamaica. I was living with my aunt at the time, and she said she didn't know what to do, so I was in limbo. I started following the wrong crowd, just up to no good. Jermaine was arrested and spent 3 months in Fulton Prison, near Hounslow, before taking up boxing. I went into the gym and challenged the coach, he remembers. I was like, come on, I'm doing street fighting. I've been on the street. I'm a street kid. I can take you. And the coach was like, come in the ring. So I finally got in the ring and everybody was watching and I said, watch me knock this coach out. He put the gloves on, we got in, and I gave him everything I had. I laid into him. He just walked through it and then went doof in my body. My soul left me. I was like, I need to learn that. Jermaine eventually settled his case with the Home Office, got indefinite leave to remain, and became a British citizen. What I try to do here is give the students a little bit about my background, because every one of these young faces that you see, they are going through their trials and tribulations, he says. As mentors, we try to use our experience to help them through that period, because no one necessarily did that for us. I meet a Year 11 student, Anthony, back in Anna's office. He was once at Stoke Newington School, not far from here, but was excluded in Year 8 and sent to the Boxing Academy for fighting too much, which is a little ironic. How does it compare? It feels like jail, he says, but it's a nice school and everything. People understand you more. There's less people, so you can get less distracted and all that. Another pupil, Megan, in Year 10, says she attended 3 other schools before ending up at the Boxing Academy. I got kicked out of mainstream in Year 7. Then I went to a pupil referral unit, then another mainstream. The last mainstream wasn't that bad. I just didn't like the rules. I used to get angry over everything. I was just a menace. She says the discipline at the Boxing Academy works. If something happens, they'll try to deal with it the same day. Sometimes in mainstream, they'll just leave it, and then everything will go out of proportion. But here they will try to deal with it the same day so we can just go back to normal. I mean, this is a small building, so obviously less people, and there's less stuff you can do. I can't bunk here. Am I going to bunk in a toilet? You can't have your phone. Nothing. I used to love bunking. A few weeks ago, Ofsted visited the Boxing Academy. It is expected to rate it outstanding in every field. Anna tells me that she wants to use the momentum behind the project to widen the curriculum, open a sixth form, perhaps create franchises across the UK. I'm properly cautious about making sure we don't get this wrong, because I think that would be heartbreaking, she says. Her staff are pushing her to open residential spaces so some of the kids can get away from their difficult home lives. All of Anna's plans depend on how Labour decides to treat academies and free schools. Reports say that the government wants to restrict their freedoms to teach outside the national curriculum, that they might give councils more power to govern how schools like the Boxing Academy are run. We don't know what happens next, Anna says. I don't think any schools do.
That was Max Jeffrey, now Michael Gove.
Education Secretary really is the best job in government, though sometimes it doesn't feel that way. Lives can be transformed, hopefully for the better, as a direct consequence of the decisions you make. But you're also firmly in the firing line. There's no other area of public policy in which everyone is an expert. Only a minority of us have fought in battle, studied the impact of nitrates on chalk streams, or contemplated what the correct approach to sanitary and phytosanitary standards should be in a trade agreement. But we've all been to school, and we all have views, sometimes deeply entrenched and emotional, about what constitutes a good education, and therefore sensible education policy. So any education secretary who wants to change things can expect to run into controversy. Ken Baker was held up to execration by teachers' unions and academics and university education departments for introducing what was considered an over-rigorous national curriculum, paper and pen tests which would leave too many students feeling like failures, and an inspection regime which judged schools against each other. David Blunkett, Charles Clark and Ruth Kelly in turn were criticised by the same unions and scorned by the same university departments for, respectively, insisting on higher standards of numeracy and literacy, bringing in unqualified teachers to the classroom through Teach First, and giving more schools greater autonomy through the Academies programme. During the 4 years I spent in the Department for Education, I built on their work. Sure enough, I found myself being attacked by the same people for much the same reasons. But while I didn't, most of the time, go out of my way to seek confrontation, I felt the whole point of being in office was to drive change. I wanted England's children to have the very best education they could. My own life was transformed by education. I spent the first 4 months of my life in care, but I was lucky to be adopted by loving parents. Both had left school at 16, and they wanted opportunities for their own children they had never been able to enjoy. Their hard work allowed them to invest time and money into my and my sister's schooling. My mother worked at the School for the Deaf in Aberdeen that my sister attended, and my father's small business profits, small in every sense, were devoted to sending me to the city's only fee-paying school for boys. I was lucky, but I was conscious that if I had not had that parental love and support, a child like me, who'd been in the care system, would have most likely faced a truncated or disrupted time in school, would have left with few or poor qualifications, and would have limited horizons in the future. My aim in government was to ensure that a child's future did not depend on contingency or chance, on accidents of birth, or the lottery of geography. Every school should be supported to strive for excellence. In opposition, I pointed out that, for all the gains we've seen in state education over preceding years, we were still falling behind nations that we should regard as comparators. And worse, the gap in our schools between the educational achievement of richer and poorer children was growing. The ambition I set was to both raise the bar and narrow the gap. It was, I maintained, both economically inefficient not to make the most of every talent and socially unjust to allow the already privileged to benefit more from schooling than those with fewer advantages. Making the case on both economic and ethical grounds seemed to me the right way to secure funding for schools at a time when austerity was looming elsewhere, and the best way to convince others that failure to reform was a moral failure. I was helped enormously by my colleague Nick Gibb, that rare thing in politics, a man without ego, only principles. He'd developed a policy programme which would improve reading in primary schools through the effective implementation of systematic synthetic phonics, a programme to improve numeracy by ensuring every student could achieve maths mastery, a programme to improve discipline by giving head teachers new powers over behaviour, and a programme to end grade inflation by making exams and league tables more honest. He'd based his approach on close study of effective classroom practice from around the world, and underpinned it with an understanding of the science of knowledge acquisition culled from wide reading of authors such as Daniel Willingham and E.D. Hirsch. He was both Sam and Gandalf to my faltering Frodo. The economic case we made helped convince George Osborne in the Treasury to ring-fence school funding. The ethical case we made convinced David Cameron to throw enormous political capital behind the revenue George gave us. And the detailed work Nick had undertaken gave us a programme ready for implementation straight after the coalition government was formed. We were also lucky in that the Liberal Democrats at that time had developed ideas on education strikingly similar to our own. That was down to the party's education spokesman at the time, David Laws, the single brightest and nicest Liberal in history, not excepting William Gladstone, Richard Haldane or Herbert Asquith. When we went into coalition with the Lib Dems, we faced, at least initially, not a messy compromise, but a happy consensus. If we had the money, the plan and the allies, why did we run into problems? Well, that's down to one big thing and many small ones. The big thing is that arguing that any system or organisation needs to change will be interpreted by many within that system or organisation as an attack on them. I argued that there was much to be proud of in our school system, and in every speech praised brilliant state schools, lauded great heads, and maintained, which was true, that we had the best generation of teachers ever in our schools. But in the ears of many, that praise was drowned out by the case that we were making for urgent change. The generous words were a string serenade, lost in the drum roll and trumpet cry for reform. Could that have been avoided? Could I have done better at carrying the profession with me? Can a public service ever be reformed without those within it hearing the case for change as, at the very least, an implicit rebuke to them for their acquiescence in underperformance? It might be possible, but I haven't seen it done. As ministers of every party have found, and are finding, challenging incumbents in any field, even in the gentlest fashion, inspires resistance. Indeed, without that challenge, without showing you are resolute for reform, you won't find allies within the quiet majority of professionals who know things can be better and who want the apologists for underperformance to be held to account. By demonstrating that we would not back down, voices within education were raised in our support, and new voices were attracted to our cause. The heads of multi-academy trusts who were empowered to transform underperforming schools, the principals of new free schools liberated to aim higher, those teachers who believed in greater rigour and ambition. They became more numerous and more vocal, precisely because the rising chorus of opposition to what we were doing in government convinced them that we were serious about change. And the small things that caused problems? Well, everything from my maladroitness in cancelling funding projects that my predecessor had invested in, such as the gift of free books through the Charity Book Trust, to the knock-on effects of requiring a 19th century novel to be taught in GCSE English literature. Some schools abandoned the text that they'd been teaching already instead of augmenting the curriculum with just one more book. So stories developed about me banning of Mice and Men and To Kill a Mockingbird, when some teachers had simply chosen to ditch them rather than to do a little more work. The allegation that I had indeed banned these enlightening texts even led to a crowd of Socialist Workers' Party activists invading the Department for Education one morning and occupying the entrance hall in protest. It was remarked by my aide that this was the first time a Tory minister had been denounced by Trotskyites for being too anti-American. But such are the curious workings of the woke mind that of Mice and Men was subsequently erased formally from the GCSE curriculum in Wales because it was deemed racist and psychologically and emotionally harmful for some black children. Wales's Children Commissioner, Rocío Cifuentes, wanted to spare the principality's 16-year-olds unnecessary trauma. Well, as I said, education policy is the one area everyone has an opinion on and is therefore treacherous ground for any politician. Together, that big problem I faced, resistance to change among many incumbents, and the little problems, the clumsy execution of some policies, were weaponized by those same teaching unions and their friends in academia who disliked being held to account for not doing better for our children. And I look back on that time with a greater degree of equanimity, because I feel the changes we made were vindicated by the progress our children have made in every international measure of school performance. But I'm left with one lesson I would pass on to anyone who gets the chance to do what is a wonderful job. If you find the unions are praising you and the academics and university education departments proclaim themselves your allies, ask yourself, as Mrs. Gateskill did of Hugh, are the wrong people clapping?
That was Michael Gove. And finally, Catriona Olding.
Molly McCarthy launched the Bloomsbury Memoir Club in the spring of 1920 with two aims. The first was to bring together the old Bloomsbury set, who'd been dissipated by the First World War, and the second was to encourage her dilatory husband Desmond to write his memoir. She was successful in the first, but not the second. The original club was composed of old friends and family members, the McCarthys, Virginia and Leonard Woolf, Vanessa and Clive Bell, Duncan Grant, Roger Fry and John Maynard Keynes. The aim was serious, but also to amuse. There were few rules, one of which was that no one should be affronted by anything read or said in the club. For years I tried to get a small memoir club going down here in Provence. Winters can be cold, dark and lonely. I was hoping to encourage Jeremy to write, if not the next literary comic novel, he gave up on that 7 years or so before he died, a memoir at least. But he was writing 800 words a week, and having failed to write a memoir in his youth, after spending a third of the publisher's advance, he was loath to try again. Not long after he died, in May 2023, I asked a few friends, Monica and Andre, the foreign correspondent and his wife Mel, and a neighbour Geoffrey, if they'd be interested in starting a memoir club. The first meeting was held on the 9th of February 2024, which would have been Jeremy's 67th birthday. The aim of our club would be to honour Jeremy, with each of us writing and reading aloud a memoir of 800 to 1,000 words. It was a success, and everyone was keen to keep it going. This year, we welcomed three new members, Jeremy's old friends Dave Goodhart and Damien McChrystal, and Dave's girlfriend Kate. At our second annual meeting, Mel kicked off the evening with an account of filming a documentary in the industrial Russian Arctic with a mini-skirted nightclub-seeking director. Monica's lovely evocation of a life told through bicycles began with her and her sisters throwing battered bikes into a hedge as the train to school approached, and ended in Provence with Andre and Jeremy visiting nearby villages on their matching Peugeot racing bikes. Kate's vivid childhood almost drowning adventure with her brother in a dinghy off the beach at Rosilly Bay in the summer of 1973 had us sitting up straight glugging rather than sipping, even though her presence assured us of a good outcome. Then there was the textbook far-left activism of middle-upper-middle-class old Etonian Dave Goodhart's youth. Rebel Dave got drunk, dropped acid and his H's before painting a giant hammer and sickle and the words, "Power to the people," underneath the high eyes, which, when some of his residents complained, he then had to paint over. Following Tartiflette and lots more wine, we were taken back to 1957, and 12-year-old Andre's charming and audacious friend, 13-year-old Annie, with her garlicky French kisses and exploring hands, which revealed to him an exciting but confusing world far beyond his beloved dinky car collection. Geoffrey introduced us to Lucifer, the orphaned baby Songlay, raised by a setter bitch belonging to a French hunter and trapper friend George. Young Lucifer burnt his little snout in the fire and, as he got bigger, liked to sit on George's lap, Trotter's on steering wheel when they drove into the village. Lucifer's life ended with a bullet to the head 5 years later when, through ill temper and bad luck rather than malice, he gored George badly in the thigh with his tusk, narrowly missing the femoral artery. His skull was pinned above the fireplace where he'd burnt his snout and stayed there until George died decades later. Damien reminded us that the 1980s were fun, another universe, where people had real sex, sometimes with people they shouldn't. When he was 25, he bumped into an ex-girlfriend's 49-year-old former model mother who asked him back to her flat. The affair was predictably short-lived. A few weeks later, the ex-girlfriend suggested a meeting. Over dinner, in a small, busy restaurant, she brought the place to a standstill by shouting, Why did you fuck my mother? Forks and glasses dangled midway between tables and mouths. Waiters froze, all faces turned. Because I love you? The fact that the evening ended passionately in his ex-girlfriend's place almost made me sorry that the excesses of the 1980s largely passed me by. I was too young, too provincial, too poor, too hard-working, and too much in love. The foreign correspondent brought things to a bloody end in a war zone. Grozny, 1994. I was glad I'd had a drink. His colleague, a young photojournalist, had been killed by a Russian vacuum bomb. Her head lay covered in a shawl in the back seat of the car, and her body, wrapped in a blanket, was strapped to the roof. There was no other way to get her out.
And that's everything for this week. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate and a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Petra Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.